may be able to listen on an alternative platform. For further information and terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/5live.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Unfortunately, due to rights restrictions, we're not able to bring you the current sports commentary on this platform. You may be able to listen on an alternative platform. For further information and terms of use, go to BBC.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the 5 Live News, I'm Laura Harms. Israel has carried out a massive attack on what it says is Hezbollah's central command headquarters in the southern suburbs of Beirut. The Lebanese health ministry has said that at least 2 people have been killed and 76 wounded. It's unclear whether the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah was there. Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari is the chief spokesman for the Israeli military.
Hezbollah's central headquarters was intentionally built under residential buildings in the heart of the Dahiya in Beirut, as part of Hezbollah's strategy of using Lebanese people as human shields.
The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, has appealed to Brits who are still in Lebanon to let the UK government know they're there so that they can be evacuated. Extra flights are leaving the country this weekend, and the Foreign Office is understood to have secured seats for British nationals. Stars of stage and screen have been remembering the Oscar-winning actress Dame Maggie Smith after her death at the age of 89. She was best known for her roles in the Harry Potter films and the Downton Abbey TV series. Hugh Bonneville, who played her on-screen son in Downton Abbey, said she was a true legend of her generation. Her Harry Potter co-star Miriam Margolyes says Dame Maggie was unique.
I mean, she had her own talent, unlike anybody else's. Ferocity, a glint of mischief, delight and tenderness. A remarkable all-round wizard.
The family of a 19-year-old man who was stabbed to death in Wolverhampton say the sentences given to his 2 13-year-old killers are too lenient. The pair, who were 12 when they murdered Sean Cesarhigh, have been sentenced to life with a minimum of 8.5 years. Lawyers for those who've accused Mohammed Al-Fayed of sexual offences say they're now working with 60 women. Justice for Harrod survivors says it's received an enormous response from victims and witnesses since a BBC documentary aired last week. And plans to significantly expand Wimbledon with 39 new tennis courts have been approved by London's Deputy Mayor of Planning. Local residents have been fighting the proposal, citing concerns about its size and damage to protected open land. Supporters say it will secure Wimbledon's future as a world tennis venue.
Hello, I'm Nihal Arthanaika.
Headliners.
We go deep with the biggest names in entertainment, culture and the arts. And I'm not trying to boast here, but look, it is what it is. Huge guest.
The comedian's comedian, Stuart Lee. I was going to be a stand-up comedian, but I would be different to the others because I would only tell the truth.
Headliners with Nihal Arthanaika. Listen on BBC Sounds. Stephen Nolan.
On BBC Radio 5 Live.
Well, as always, there's a lot to talk about tonight. Labour's election promise of a non-dom tax on super-rich foreigners living in the UK might now be watered down or even scrapped over fears it'll simply drive the super-wealthy abroad. So here's the choice. Scrap the non-dom tax and keep the wealthy and their cash here, or face down the threats from the super-rich to take their billions elsewhere. Do you support a non-dom tax? We're looking to hear from you tonight, 0808 509 693. It's not the only challenge facing the new government. The questions about freebie culture just won't go away.
I'll be honest, it was a hard one to turn down. It was declared. I've been clear about that. But I do recognise that, you know, I'm in a fortunate position to be able to receive it.
I was offered them. I had not seen my children for the election period. I thought it was a nice treat for them. I confess I'm not really a Swiftie for my kids.
Should you have taken it? I understand the premise that you've explained, but should you have taken it on the basis of what people like Rachel are saying?
It was an evening I had free when I had the kids in London. It was a nice thing for them to do.
That's the Cabinet Ministers, Bridget Phillipson and Darren Jones. Should a government minister be taking free tickets to see Taylor Swift? Is that a perk or just part of the job? 0808 509 693. Also tonight, There was also really powerful testimony at the COVID inquiry this week on the human costs of the pandemic for those on the front line, treating people as the NHS was stretched to its limits.
We had nurses talking about patients raining from the sky, where the nurses said that they... One of the nurses told me that they just got tired of putting people in body bags.
Another account from a senior doctor, Kevin Fong, went viral this week. He said staff on the front line face scenes from hell. If you're in the NHS and worked during the pandemic, how are you now? How have those experiences affected you? We're all about your calls. Here's how to get in touch.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Call free 08085 909 693. Text 85058. Text will be charged at your standard message rate.
Visit bbc.co.uk/5liveterms
for our terms of use and privacy notice. Stephen Nolan
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Good evening. We lead tonight with Israel. It says it's attacked Hezbollah headquarters in Beirut following huge explosions, which Israel describes as a precise strike in the Lebanese capital. Lebanese officials say two people were killed and 76 injured. In the last hour, the Israeli military has ordered residents of some areas of southern Beirut to evacuate. There had been reports that Hezbollah's leader, Nassan Nasrallah, had been the ultimate target of the raids, but he's reported in some Middle Eastern media as being in a safe place. Lebanese officials say two people killed, 76 injured. The attacks came less than an hour after Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told the United Nations General Assembly in New York that his country was fighting for its life and that the offensive against Hezbollah would not end until Israel's objectives had been met.
I didn't intend to come here this year. My country is at war, fighting for its life. But after I heard the lies and slanders leveled at my country by many of the speakers at this podium, I decided to come here and set the record straight. We face savage enemies who seek our annihilation, and we must defend ourselves against these savage murderers. Our enemies seek not only to destroy us, they seek to destroy our common civilization and return all of us to a dark age of tyranny and terror. As long as Hezbollah chooses the path of war, Israel has no choice and Israel has every right to remove this threat and return our citizens to their homes safely. And that's exactly what we're doing.
In response, Hezbollah says it targeted areas in northern Israel with rockets. It says, quote, in defense of Lebanon and its people and in response to the, the barbaric Israeli violation of cities, villages and civilians. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has been speaking in the last few minutes. He says the path to diplomacy is still open.
The objective that Israel has in the first instance in Lebanon is an important and legitimate one. It's creating an environment that's secure enough to enable people to return home. Because remember what happened on starting October 8th. Hezbollah started lobbing rockets and missiles into Israel, trying to create another front in the war. And Israel, of course, had to respond to that. And in the process, tens of thousands of people had to evacuate their homes. In northern Israel, villages and homes were destroyed. Southern Lebanon, and so we have large populations, both in Israel and in Lebanon, who've been forced from their homes. And it is a legitimate and important objective for Israel to, again, create an environment in which people can get back to their homes. The question is, what's the best way to do that? What is the most effective, sustainable way to do that? We believe many other countries who joined us in putting out a call for a ceasefire for 21 days believe that the best way to do that is through diplomacy, through a ceasefire and then reaching an agreement.
Well, the former BBC correspondent Jim Muir with us tonight. How likely is it to reach an agreement, given what we're seeing here, Jim?
I would say totally
unlikely, because Benjamin Netanyahu has shown that he is just shrugging off whatever pressures there may be from Washington and Washington's allies, who put out that statement just, what, a couple of days ago, calling for an immediate ceasefire and talks and so on. He's actually staged a dramatic escalation by attacking the headquarters where Hassan Nasrallah, the Hezbollah chief, may well have been. And if he was, then, you know, the word out of Israel is he may well have been killed. That was the objective of the whole operation. That's why Mr. Netanyahu went late to New York and left early and ran out of a meeting with journalists at one stage just as the thing was going on. So it's a very big deal from Israel's point of view. And I think they have killed Nasrallah. Meanwhile, of course, they're actually keeping it up. They've warned two little areas in the southern suburbs. They've warned people there to get away from certain named buildings in three buildings, saying those are Hezbollah things. They're going to be hit. Get 500 meters away from them. So we can probably expect some more big bangs in the night.
Aren't they tipping off Hezbollah to get out too?
I suppose you could say that, yeah. It is extraordinary to do this. This is what they were doing in Gaza, don't forget. I mean, they seem now to be treating Beirut like Gaza, issuing warnings to specific areas for people to get out of harm's way because operations are going to happen. So, yes, you're right. I mean, it does give, assuming these are Hezbollah occupied buildings, it would give them time to evacuate as well, but it would also presumably be destroying all the infrastructure there, and that's probably partly at least what it's about. But also fear. I mean, they're definitely spreading fear. The bangs that we heard today were unlike anything I've ever heard in Lebanon in the very long time I've been covering it. I mean, the volume of noise, the 10 explosions, one after the other, linked so closely, it was like one thing, and literally over in about 2 or 3 seconds, with bunker buster bombs, 2,000-pound bombs, causing massive damage.
Jim, what I don't, one of the many things I don't understand about this, is that the Western allies, for Israel, the likes of the Americans, let's take them as an example, and they're calling for diplomacy, and then we see Israel do this. It's the lack of coordination between the Americans calling for diplomacy and then Israel issuing these massive strikes. It's nearly as if the Americans don't know what Israel is about to do, and yet Israel doesn't operate without that support from the Americans. So what's going on?
It is very, very, very strange, Stephen. I think we're all a bit baffled by that relationship. I mean, the Americans are always saying, we've got your back to Israel, we support you, etc. They're providing them with billions of dollars of money, and all the weapons that we're seeing deployed are American weapons. Now, in previous conflicts between Israel and either the Palestinians in Lebanon or now Hezbollah in Lebanon, there was always a kind of measure of American restraint, because at the end of the day, they can crack the whip and say, no more weapons, no more money if you don't back down. So there was always, I always thought of it as a kind of like an elastic band attached to the Israelis. They could go so far and then they would be pulled back. Now that elastic band doesn't seem to be there at all. It seems that Mr. Netanyahu can just blithely shrug off. It's almost humiliating, in my view, for the Americans. I mean, they put out a hard-worked statement just 2 days ago calling for an immediate ceasefire, and then there's this immediate massive escalation by the Israelis. It's almost as though
that's my point.
They're deliberately flouting them. Yeah, exactly. It's baffling, but they don't have a grip. I mean, they just don't have the grip.
After the airstrikes, after the pagers that blew up and the mobiles, what capability does Hezbollah still have?
Well, they're, even after the massive blast today, they're firing off rockets. I mean, I look at the stream of their news, and it's all, you know, we fired, you know, 15 rockets here at Safed or places in northern Israel. So they're signaling that they're still in business. Now, the big question hanging over Beirut at the moment, and hanging over Hezbollah, is if Hassan Nasrallah has been killed, How big a difference is that going to make? The Israelis have managed to nobble, I would say, a very large proportion of the Hezbollah military leaders and commanders, yet they seem to have understudies who step in straight away. So, for example, when the guy in charge of firing rockets and missiles was killed last week, the first thing that happened was 150 missiles get fired off into Israel. So they're still sort of in business, still functioning away. They seem to have a very flexible command structure, despite the fact their communications must be now greatly hampered. They can't use mobile phones, they can't use pagers, they can't use walkie-talkies. So they're hampered in that way, but they seem to have enough autonomy and enough flexibility built into their command structures that they can continue functioning. But given, as I say, the big question is, can they function without their supreme leader?
Well, given who's backing them, Jim, does that mean that they'll always be able to continue to function?
Well, if we're talking about Iran, of course, and the question
Correct.
Is, at what point does Iran feel it has to intervene itself? And it seems to be getting close to that, judging from the reaction in Tehran to what's been going on today here. And the Iranian embassy here has said that, you know, this is a very dangerous crime, a criminal escalation, which changes the rules of the game. And in Tehran, they're talking about a red line having been crossed. Well, this is probably, in the view of many people in Israel itself, what Netanyahu actually wants is to goad the Iranians into a war into which America would also get drawn. Now, the Americans have been aware of this danger from the very beginning. They don't want to get drawn into war with Iran. But the way things are going and the way they're unable to kind of impose their will or any kind of control over the Israelis, it could well happen whether they want it or not.
How big a force is Iran? Play that out for us.
Well, that is the question. Of course, the Israelis, especially if they had American help and support, could do a lot of damage. And what they're after, of course, is Iran's nuclear facilities. That's what they'd like to hit and take out. Now, the Iranians have got a lot of forces, but that doesn't necessarily add up. We're talking about very high-tech warfare here, and they're probably not on the same level as the Israelis. So the Israelis could probably do a huge amount of damage. The question is, how much would that spread? Would Iran regard, for example, American bases in the on the Arab side of the Gulf as legitimate targets? Would the militias, the Iranian-backed militias in Iraq, for example, and Syria, be unleashed onto American bases there because they've still got quite a few hundred troops there? That's what the Americans are worried about. It could engulf the Arab countries of the Gulf, and it could engulf Americans who are dotted around in bases all over the place. That's the kind of fears that people have.
And how quickly does World War III start then?
Well, I think that's...
America are engaged, it could go anywhere, right?
Yeah. It could, yes. I don't think we've got, I mean, we're talking about the Russians, Chinese and things. I mean, they're quite close to Iran, but I don't think they're so close that they would get involved in physical fisticuffs. No, it would be a very nasty regional war, but not a world war. The Jordanian foreign minister has just been on saying that Netanyahu is dragging the region into a war and he has to be stopped. And he means, of course, the Americans have to stop him. Looking back at 1982, for example, when the Israelis were up around Beirut besieging it, President Reagan was much tougher. I mean, he cut off weapons to Israel and he really, you know, was much more tough with the Israelis than Biden is turning out to be. Of course, it's very close to election in America, and there are huge considerations there. So, you know, it's a kind of being savaged by a dead sheep situation as far as American strictures on Israel are concerned.
And do we know if Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, those two candidates at that American election, would significantly lead to a change of policy around this?
It's really hard to say because all American politicians have to kind of genuflect to Israel and say how much they support Israel and so on. It's just, it goes with the territory. But Kamala Harris has been more outspoken about the level of casualties in Gaza, for example, and on pressing for a ceasefire and so on. So if she was actually in charge, she might be a little bit tougher with the Israelis than President Biden has turned out to be. As for Trump, I mean, you know, he's just so difficult to read. He might actually be the one to be really tough with the Israelis, but on the other hand, you might just say, yeah, get on and do it, you know, throw the Palestinians out of the West Bank and let's get it all over and done with, you know. You just don't know with Trump because he's just such a wild card, he's impossible to predict.
Emma Bartholomew is listening to this and lives in the city. Good evening to you, Emma.
Hi. Just a correction, Stephen. I don't live in Beirut. I'm here at the moment. I've been back and forth between here and London this year, but this is my...
Thank you.
That's where I am right Thank now, you. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that, Emma. What's it like to be there? Tell me what you're seeing and what it feels like.
Well, until today, the area of Beirut that I'm in at the moment has felt relatively calm. There's been definitely an atmosphere of anticipation and anxiety and a feeling of déjà vu amongst, certainly amongst my Lebanese friends and the community here. Last week, obviously, was a huge escalation, and we had several days where the air was gridlocked with the sound of sirens nonstop for hours at a time. But this evening was the first time that I personally felt the blast force and certainly heard it. So that's slightly changed the atmosphere where I am, because we obviously know that this was a huge bombardment. And so, yeah, I think there's... The Lebanese people are very well known for their resilience and their determination to continue in the face of absolutely constant adversity that's been thrown at them, not just through war, but through all sorts of economic and governmental problems over the years. And so there's always a sense to continue, but I think there's definitely a palpable anxiety right now.
And when that blast that you describe, and at the point it strikes, look, what happens around that? What do people literally do?
Well, when the blast happened this evening, I was actually completely alone in my room, so I couldn't see other people around me. But I quite quickly went to a place where I knew that there would be other people to see the reaction and see if we should be moving or if there was a sense that we needed to do something different. I am in a hotel at the moment. I would normally be in a more residential area, but I'm staying in a hotel this time. And already people were packing up and leaving. So I think there was a sense that perhaps people had thought that they might be safer in the city and they were now really worried. Humans everywhere adapt, but I think especially here, people are just, they're programmed to just very quickly absorb the shock and then take the next step. And that is a sense that we kind of absorb as visitors if we're lucky enough to be here, which I know that may sound a crazy thing to say at the moment, but this is an incredibly beautiful country with amazing people. And even during the troubles over the last couple of weeks, every single day when I've looked around the city and looked out at the Mediterranean Sea, I've felt lucky to be here. It's a difficult feeling knowing that I have the option to leave when that is an available option, because it hasn't actually been that available for the last week.
Are there flights available to leave? How do British citizens get out? I know the Foreign Office, the UK Foreign Office, has urged all British citizens in Lebanon to leave now. How easy is it to get out?
Well, last week when things started, when the pager attack started, and then we had three consecutive days of things happening, attacks happening, It certainly didn't feel like the best idea to possibly travel to the airport. You have to go through a Hezbollah area to get to the airport. So I personally didn't look into flights at that time because I felt like I needed to just stay in a safe area. This week, when things escalated dramatically on Monday, I started to look at bringing my existing flight forward. There were no flights available until the October. And I had already registered with the British Embassy. So I contacted them again to say, I'm on your register, but is there anything I need to do in case that there is an evacuation arranged? This was the Keir Starmer into the headlines that all expats should leave immediately. And the slightly infuriating reality was on that day, it would have been impossible to leave because there were no flights leaving and nothing available to book for at least 10 days. So it did throw, I was lucky to remain calm and to feel, I have a great support network here, so I didn't feel any panic. But I'm sure if people are here without resources, without support networks, they would have really panicked that day. Being told to leave, but with actually no option available to them. We haven't been contacted individually by the embassy. And the response to the message, I sent a message in writing because I felt that it was important to have a written record of my situation and the questions that I was asking. And I received a very much copy and pasted response with references to the Foreign Office website, the page on Lebanon on the website, with no direct responses to my questions. I kept it very short and succinct, but there were two questions that were very clear, which was, should I register for a specific evacuation list? And that question wasn't answered in the generic response that I received. And since then, we've been receiving text messages to remind us to register. But again, I think today the message did slightly change after the blasts, with the additional piece of information that new flights would be made available so that we should start checking to see if there was any availability on those new flights. But this evening when the blast went off, there were reports in the local media, which we follow immediately because we receive WhatsApp notifications every time something happens. And one of the reports said that there had been blasts close to the airport. I don't know if that's verified, so I don't know if that's correct information, but a couple of days ago, we certainly received a notification, which was a circular from USAID, one of the NGOs that operates here, saying, do not go to the airport, do not go to the port, do not travel on the highways, because they had all been named as targets. So, you know, the balance of making a decision at the moment is obviously essential to keep a clear head. But when you felt the blast force, it can obviously knock out your logic slightly for momentarily.
Are you frightened being there?
Honestly, I haven't been until this point. I felt lucky to be very calm, and I've been feeling very pragmatic. I think what happened tonight, the extent of it, was a shock, and what happened on Monday, the number of fatalities as a result of the attacks was a huge shock. There was a huge influx of people fleeing from the southern suburbs, which was the area that was attacked tonight, the Bekaa Valley, and also across the south of the country on Monday, and that brought it definitely closer to realizing that this was a very, very changeable and volatile situation. And I think for me, there's been a couple of moments that have really brought it home. One day was last Thursday when I was actually on the roof of my hotel following Hassan Nasrallah's speech, which was being very usefully translated into English immediately. And as I was watching it, the Israeli jets flew over and broke the sound barrier. So we had these two sonic booms, which immediately sound like explosions, which made me think, OK, it's really real now because it's come into the city. Luckily, that was just the sound barrier being broken, but that's obviously a form of psychological warfare, which really works because it does really scare people. And I think the moment on Monday when I started to see real human beings with real lives, bringing those real lives into the area of Beirut that I'm staying in, and seeing the anguish on their faces as they literally must have picked up children, the few belongings that they could bring with them, and dashed in their car into the capital. And as they were arriving, they were also still receiving phone calls, which were obviously giving them very harrowing news of people who they'd left behind. And people were, family groups were crying and wailing with the news that they were receiving. And that was a very helpless feeling because, you know, who am I as a as an outsider to lend any kind of support, really? I'm really just here being fortunate to be here, but I can't possibly imagine what those people had just been through and continue to go through. And I think
you witnessed the after effect of it.
Absolutely. Well, the after effect, and to be honest, it's so ongoing that it's an after effect, but it's just a pummeling that keeps happening and keeps happening and keeps happening. And I think the frightening thing this evening for the community, especially in the southern suburbs, is these evacuation orders that they've been receiving from the IDF, because they have seen what has happened in Gaza in those areas that were receiving evacuation orders. And the worry is that people will flee and then be attacked in the places that they've gone to seek safety. That does have a ripple effect across the whole city, because then the rest of us in the whole city are wondering how far will the ripple effect of those bombardments actually go. So we can't go into panic, and we can't do anything but to remain calm, because that will just make the situation worse. But it has become such a volatile situation that you wouldn't be human if you said you weren't a little bit frightened, I think, at this stage.
Thank you for talking to me tonight. Really appreciate it. Jim, I guess the last question for you is, what do we expect this weekend? Do we know?
Well, nothing good. Nothing good. The Israelis, as we've been talking about, have ordered people to move out of parts of the southern suburbs on pain of being caught, presumably by the kind of bombs that we heard going off earlier in the day. And they're keeping up attacks elsewhere. I mean, we're talking about Beirut suburbs and the possible death of Nasrallah, but there's still other bombardments going on in different parts of the country, in the south and the Bekaa Valley and so on. And Hezbollah is, as I said, trying to keep up you may call it illusion, or at least the trying to demonstrate that they're still in business by firing off volleys of rockets into Israel. So it's going on. And unless, the Americans somehow get a grip on Israel and pull them back and try and impose a ceasefire, it's just going to go on. And possibly with the specter of Iran getting involved and it turning into the regional escalation, the regional flare-up that people have been trying to avoid for nearly a year now, since the whole thing started last October.
Okay. Jim Muir, thank you as well. Thank you for talking to us this evening. Coming up tonight, it's been a while since COVID dominated the headlines, but it hasn't gone away. The Chinese authorities have warned that the coronavirus is still evolving in potentially dangerous ways. In London on Thursday, we got a reminder of the darkest days of the pandemic at the official inquiry into Britain's handling of COVID. Professor Kevin Fong saw the impact in hospitals at first hand in his role as the National Health Service's advisor for emergency preparedness.
We had nurses talking about patients raining from the sky, where the nurses said that they, one of the nurses told me that they just got tired of putting people in body bags. Now, the hospital, where they said that sometimes they were so overwhelmed that they were putting patients in body bags, lifting them from the bed, putting them on the floor, putting another patient in that bed straight away because there wasn't time. We went to another unit where things got so bad, they were so short of resource, they ran out of body bags, and they were instead issued with 9-foot clear plastic sacks and cable ties. And those nurses talk about being really traumatized by that because they had recurring nightmares about feeling like they were just throwing bodies away. These people are used to seeing death, but not on that scale and not like that. And whatever the figures show you, the experience for them was indescribable.
Well, if you're in the NHS and you did work during the pandemic, and many of you would have, obviously, maybe it is the right time for you to share your experiences. If you can, 0885-909-693. Later in the programme tonight, we'll speak to Dr. Paul Efthimiu, a spokesperson and ambassador for Doctors in Distress, who worked on the ICU COVID ward during the pandemic. Let's pause there. We'll get the news at 10:34.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the 5 Live headlines, I'm Shoujo Sarka. The Israeli military has carried out a large attack on what it says is Hezbollah's central command headquarters in Beirut. The Lebanese health ministry has said at least 2 people have been killed and 76 wounded. The King and Queen have paid tribute to Dame Maggie Smith, who's died at the age of 89. They've released a statement calling her a national treasure and praising her warmth and wit as an actress. During her 70-year career, Dame Maggie won 2 Oscars and 5 BAFTAs. Lawyers for those who have accused Mohammed Al-Fayed of sexual offences say they're now working with 60 women. Justice for Harrods Survivors says it's received an enormous response from victims and witnesses since a BBC documentary aired last week. And Just Stop Oil supporters have thrown soup over 2 Vincent van Gogh paintings just hours after 2 activists were given prison sentences. Phoebe Plummer and Anna Holland were jailed for throwing soup at the painting Sunflowers in 2022. In sport, England's cricketers have levelled up their one-day international series against Australia at 2-2 after a massive 186-run victory in a rain-affected match at Lord's. Eleanor Aldred reports.
After 2 heavy defeats in the first 2 games of the series, a stunning performance with bat and ball gave England a massive win by 186 runs. A delayed start, overs reduced to 39 aside after morning rain. Harry Brooke with 87 and Ben Duckett 63 gave England a solid foundation. But Liam Livingstone broke the Lord's ODI records for fastest 50 off 25 balls and most runs in an over, 28 off Mitchell Stark's final over, to set Australia a target of 313. They made a decent start. They were 68 without loss, then collapsed to 96 for 6 thanks to the pace of Archer and Cass and the accuracy of Potts. Australia all out for 126 and the teams go to Bristol with all to play for on Sunday.
In rugby league, Lee Leopards produced a spirited performance to win 14-6 away at Salford to book their place in the Super League semi-finals. Newly promoted Crystal Palace endured another tough night in the Women's Super League. They were humbled 7-0 at Selhurst Park by the reigning champions Chelsea. In the Championship, Plymouth edged out Luton 3-1 at Home Park. Tranmere and Salford City drew 0-0 in League 2. In Rugby Union's Premiership, Christian Wade scored a hat-trick as Gloucester beat Bristol 44-41 in the United Rugby Championship. Leinster recorded a 34-6 bonus point win over Dragons, while Glasgow ran in 6 tries as they thrashed Benetton 42-10. And the All England Club say they are looking to complete 39 new tennis courts at Wimbledon between 2030 and 2033. The plans, which also include a new 800-seater stadium, have been given the go-ahead by the Greater London Authority despite strong local opposition. Campaigners could still seek a judicial review.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
Stephen Nolan.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now, the Treasury is reconsidering parts of Labour's manifesto plan for non-domiciled tax status over worries that the reforms will bring in less money than expected. There is concern that plan changes, which aim to raise extra money to spend on public services like the NHS, could prompt wealthy foreigners to simply get out of the country. Should we keep the wealthy and their cash here or face down the threats from the super rich to take their billions elsewhere? This is what you had to say on Nikki's show this morning.
If we want a criminal justice system that works, if we want a functioning NHS, then the money has to come from somewhere. And I think that the people who have already been squeezed and have been struggling have been asked for enough. And we now need to be asking the people who actually can contribute to do so.
The people who've been paying 9 billion, they're not all going to go, but let's say half of them go. It's 4.5 billion shortfall. The rest of us are going to have to pick up that tab. You have to create a climate where wealth creators feel welcome.
But, I mean, non-doms, we know we're very mobile. We didn't need the OBR to come out with this analysis of Oxford Economics, actually. We just have history to tell us. So, how on earth the government can get to this point now, it's another embarrassment for them to have to do another U-turn, you know, on something which they've had years to work on. But generally on tax, let me just say, I think UK, as has been pointed out, we're sort of about middle of the road, middle of the pack in terms of tax take, although we're at a record level for the UK out of wartime. You know, we're sort of middle of that. But actually, we already tax quite highly, relatively, the sort of top 1%. The amount we get from the top 1% is relatively high.
So let's see what you think tonight. 0885-909-693. Dr. Aaron Advani is an economist director of the Centre for the Analysis of Taxation. Aaron, good evening.
Evening.
Evening. And Lee Harris, broadcaster, political commentator. Hello, Lee.
Hi, Stephen. Good evening.
Hello. Let's start at the beginning. Hiya, Lee. Let's start at the beginning, Dr. Allen. Explain to us what non-doms are and how the tax break works.
So to be a non-dom, that just means that your permanent home, you say, is outside of the UK. So anyone who comes to this country and says, well, I'm here at the moment, but I'm intending ultimately to go away again, if that's currently my plan, they're a non-dom. Not all of them. Most of them, in fact, won't make any use of any tax breaks. They come here and they just sort of live here and live among us like everybody else. If you have enough investment income, so income from dividends, from renting out houses, from capital gains, from abroad, you might say it's worth me ticking a specific box that says not only am I non-dom, but I want to make use of a particular tax break. That tax break is called the remittance basis. And what it means is basically you don't pay tax on foreign income or foreign capital gains, investment income or foreign capital gains, as long as you don't bring it into the country. And the reform that's been proposed so far is, firstly, to stop this test being based on domicile, this like where do I feel like I live, and being based on residence, so how many years have I actually spent in the UK, and that's all we're going to count, because that's then something we can be sure of rather than trying to guess what people actually feel. And the second thing is to reduce that kind of the ability to have that overseas investment income not being taxed. Currently that's for 15 years it's not taxed, and the proposal is to move that from 15 years down to 4 years.
So that's money they're making where they were born in a foreign country.
May not be where they're born. So it could be that they came from abroad and they, before they come to the UK, move their income to somewhere where it's typically not going to be taxed in the other country because they're not tax resident in another country. They're tax resident here. So other countries typically won't tax it unless there's a withholding tax. Some countries have a withholding tax. It's usually still much, much lower rates than headline income tax rates. So it won't be taxed by the other country because the other country will say, well, you're living in the UK now. The UK should tax it. Tax this money. You know, if a British person goes and lives in Germany, we won't tax that income. Germany will tax it. But if a German comes to the UK, Germany will say, well, it's not our problem to tax it. The UK now gets the right to tax it because this German is living in the UK. But we would say, but if they're claiming non-dom status, we're unilaterally giving up the right to that tax. Even though Germany has said, well, we shouldn't be taxing it. We think you should tax it. We would be giving up that right. And that's currently what we do.
And it's the richest that do it, is it? How much do we lose from that? How much is that tax break worth?
So we did some work on this a couple of years ago, and we said that there was something like £3.5 billion of overseas investment income and capital gains that is potentially taxable and could be taxable in the UK if non-doms didn't have access to the remittance basis and instead were taxed like UK individuals. And that was after accounting for the fact that these individuals, as we're presumably going to go and talk about, have connections to other countries and many of them have some chance of migrating. So we looked at how many of them migrated in response to previous reforms. So we are taking into account that kind of effect. And we said there's about £3.5 billion, we thought, from the incoming gains for these people.
And so the big gamble, the roll of the dice, is whether you go after them or not and they just get out of the country, or actually it's a big money maker for this country.
And so the interesting thing, or the nice thing here, is that there was a reform in 2017 that George Osborne introduced when he previously said we should limit this tax break. It used to be an indefinite tax break and he limited it to 15 years. And so we can look at that reform and say, well, what happened to people who were affected by that reform? The first thing to say is, as actually one of your kind of speakers earlier was just saying, one of the voices we heard, was these people are very mobile. You know, in the absence of any tax reform, long before George Osborne did anything, even people who'd been in the country for 15 years coming from abroad, you know, 1 in 20 of them in any given year would still choose to leave the country. So there's quite a high rate of people leaving anyway. So people do, they are very mobile anyway. Just independently.
1 in 20? Is that high?
1 in 20. Yeah, 5%. That's pretty high. I mean, for someone who's UK born, it'd be more like 1 in 1,000. So 1 in 20 of them leaving is pretty high. As a baseline. And what we saw as a result of the reform, the tax reform that took place, was it went from about 5% of them, 1 in 20 of them leaving, to about 10% of them leaving in the year immediately after the reform. And it only had that effect for 1 year. And then basically anyone who wanted to leave left in that year. And then after that, it went back down. And this is, so 5% of them left as a result of a 20% increase in their tax bill. And so, you know, overall, there's quite a lot of them paying quite a lot more. A small share of them, 5%, left. And among those that 5% who left, on average, they don't stop paying taxes in the UK. They reduce their tax in the UK, but there are various things that might mean you're still taxable in the UK if you choose, for example, to own UK property and rent that out to somebody, or if you still keep some job that you're doing in the UK while living abroad, which happened for a lot of these people. And so what you find is even those people who left are still paying 40% as much tax as they were when they were here. So there's still tax paid by the people who leave, because for them it's not about being completely out of the country. It's that they spend more time abroad relative to how much they've spent here, but they already spend a lot of time in lots of other countries already for this kind of group.
Hey, Lee Harris, broadcaster, political commentator, are you not worried about losing these people?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I think we've already heard from the OBR, haven't we, that the savings that the government wants to make were already kind of estimated to be wiped out. I think it was Henley and Partners did a report to say that around the estimations around 9,500 people that have got at least sort of 1 million quid's worth in liquid investable assets will leave the country. And that's more than double the number that left in 2023. So it is kind of a significant amount of people that could leave. And these non-doms, who are obviously highly mobile and very, very wealthy, they raise about £8.5 billion quid's worth of tax for HMRC through income, capital gains tax and national insurance. You know, many non-doms contribute significantly through taxes on UK properties, businesses and capital gains, you know, plus their spending and investments help fuel the economy. And that supports it, you know, that's through supporting businesses, creating jobs and boosting growth. And they're also very likely to use things like private healthcare, schools and banking services, which will add to GDP. They'll also, you know, buy and rent property and spend their vast amounts of money here, you know, more money for the treasury. You know, and other countries like sort of Spain and Portugal have copied this system as it's kind of economically.
But it's
beneficial.
Special rules for the rich. Like it can't be anything other than that, isn't it?
Well, agreed.
It's special rules. And yeah. How do people who stomach that? How can
but
people
those special rules
that?
Lead to more money for the treasury is the argument that they would put forward, you know. So yes, we would, but because what happens if you remove those special rules is, as we're starting to see, you see a lot of capital flight and these very mobile, very wealthy individuals will just get up and leave. And we are starting to see evidence of that already. And that is the worry, is that, and of course the OBR have backed this up a little bit with their estimates of how, so, you know, I'm not saying that we shouldn't, tax wealthy individuals. You know, they are paying a fair share of tax. And there's also something that does wind me up. This is slightly less technical, but it does kind of wind me up a little bit. It's quite regularly, and this is more of a political point, is you'll hear Rachel Reeves say, she will actually say that non-doms don't pay any tax. And I know she's kind of twisting the truth slightly, because of course they do pay tax, as I've just explained, through in the UK. They pay all the tax they should do from being in the UK. And they're not paying tax on money that's earned out of the country. So it's a slight misconception. I think they just kind of hope that that soundbite sticks, of which it kind of does with a lot of people. So yes, you are right. There is a worry, and it does seem to be slightly backed up with facts that we are going to see capital flight if Labour go too hard on this. I mean, we're already seeing, as I said, there's about 69,000 non-DOMs who are already in the UK that, you know, they're very, very mobile. And we've already had uncertainty put into the market by Rachel Reeves and Starmer, you know, by saying that they're going to do this. And a lot of them have already started to make plans.
You can see, Dr. Advani, the political pressure the Labour Party are under right from the off of their new administration over the winter fuel payment. I wonder how much is this decision going to come down to the optics, to the politics of asking people, you know, ordinary working people in this country to pay more out of their pockets and meanwhile be seen to give some type of tax break to the rich. Like, can Labour even pull that off, even if they want to?
I mean, the politics are sort of, in some sense, above my pay grade. I guess the thing I would say is, I don't think the OBR clearly hasn't released a statement at this stage. There's some sort of leak that was reported in The Guardian a couple of days ago. I think from my understanding of what I've read about it, the suggestion isn't that removing the non-DOM status won't raise revenue. It's that the additional bit of the reform that Labour were proposing beyond what Jeremy Hunt was proposing in its current form might not raise additional revenue. So it's still the case that you'll get the £3-ish billion that was being promised under that the OBR already scored in March against this reform. And the claim is that that's as much as you'll get and you won't get more than that. I'm not sure that's true, but there's definitely some uncertainty there about exactly how much you would raise. But I don't think that there's any sense in which doing the reform overall is actually going to lose money. I think the claim that was being made in the newspapers was that you won't get more money than Jeremy Hunt already scored, rather than that. So it's not a claim that you should keep the current status. It's that Jeremy Hunt was going as far as you could go. I'm not sure that's right. I think the other thing to say about that is, if there is a leak that says that that is what's the case, it's worth remembering that the way that these scoring processes work is they are naturally very dependent on the nature of the way the policy is structured. So the bit that people have been, when you talk to non-DOMs, the bits that they say they're most concerned about is the reform to inheritance tax. That wasn't something that was in the Conservative reform in March. It is proposed by Labour that non-DOMs after 10 years would be covered by inheritance tax as anyone in the UK would be. And so 9 years and 364 days, there's no inheritance tax to pay. You get to that one day over and suddenly you jump to the 40% rate. Now, we know a lot of people don't actually pay that 40% rate, even when they have high levels of wealth. That's in HMRC's official statistics. But that's still a concern for people. A fairly natural thing to do, I think a fairly sensible thing to do, would be to not have such a sharp cliff edge going from a 0% to a 40%. And maybe to say, well, okay, after 10 years of being here, you go up to 5% or 8%. After a couple more years, you go up a bit more. A couple more years, you go up a bit more. And so eventually you can get to that 40% if you want to, or whatever that rate is, whatever we keep inheritance tax rates at, we go up to that rate. But we do it sort of slowly. And then there's not such a kind of key decision point where you sit down with your partner and say, look, if we stay here one more year, we're going to go into this much, much higher rate. And that might be a sensible way to do it, and that might reduce any migration effects that would be scored against the current version of the reform that's been proposed.
It's a lot of estimates going on. Let's see how
it plays out, Dr. Aaron Advani. Thank you. Lee Harris, thank you very much as well. Next, COVID, back in the headlines this week after this powerful testimony at the inquiry.
I was greeted at the entrance by one of the intensive care registrars. I asked him immediately what things had been like. He replied, I'll never forget, he replied, it's been like a terrorist attack every day since this started, and we don't know when the attacks are going to stop. And I remember thinking that's, you know, for them, that wasn't a hyperbolic statement. They'd admitted an average of 8 intensive care patients per day during the whole of that period.
That account from Professor Kevin Wong went viral this week. Dr. Paul, FMU is spokesperson and ambassador for Doctors in Distress. Good evening to you, Paul.
Good evening.
Good evening. You worked on a COVID-19 ward during the pandemic. Are you left with images that you should be able to forget but can't?
There's definitely moments looking back where you will have a lot of difficulty forgetting the things that we saw. It was an echoing Professor Fong's statement. I don't think there's a doctor in the country that can't relate in some respect to the things that he said. We were greeted with something that was completely unknown, and we are still facing the consequences of that to this day.
And what are those consequences? What are those impacts in terms of how many of our physicians are living their lives now?
I think because we went from going from a COVID environment to going back to essentially a normal working hospital environment, there's never really been a time where doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals have actually been able to decompress from the events and the trauma that they actually experienced. So there is this ongoing burnout, which is getting worse. And we see that in doctors in distress through the forums and through the number of people coming through. So it's something that we do need to address and actually take note of, that it is still having an impact.
Having an impact on current patient care, or just as important, having an impact on how our doctors and nurses are able to live happy lives, or both?
I think we're all very good at putting on a brave face, as we were during the actual pandemic itself. So whilst it's not impacting patient care itself, in that we're still doing our jobs diligently and well, it's still something that you don't know what goes on behind closed doors. And I do feel that there are a large number of healthcare staff that we're still feeling the repercussions of it, not dissimilar to how soldiers would feel after a time at war. We see them in society, see them doing everyday tasks, but mental health and burnout are things that go quite unnoticed and go under the radar. So it can be very difficult to pinpoint exactly what it is that's causing it and how it actually impacts each person's life. But everyone has their own stories, and when you do listen to them, you do notice small things that seem to come through.
Like what?
So there are people that may be having difficulty sleeping, for example, feeling very restless at work. You feel that you don't have the energy anymore to get up, to go to work, you find yourself very irritable. And these are all small signs that start to come through. And what can initially be dismissed as depression or things that someone's just having a bad day are actually just the surface of what is a bigger problem. And some of those problems can be addressed, can be cut back to the COVID days.
What are the moments that haunt you, Paul? Can you share any of them with us?
There were certainly a few where you feel very helpless. So there was instances where patients are struggling to breathe. And one of the instances I certainly remember is one of the most distressing things to see is someone not able to catch their breath and essentially suffocating. You can see the fear in their eyes, and you have the fear yourself that you can do very little. And it's one of the worst things to see. So I have certainly few images of those, and subsequently seeing patients pass away in front of you after you've done everything that you can do for them is very heartbreaking. And also, as a doctor working in intensive care, you naturally want to bring family in, you want to be involved, have them up to date with everything, and you want them to be by the bedside with their loved ones to have a dignified passing. But unfortunately, with the COVID situation as it was, it went against everything that we would normally do on a day-to-day basis. So it was very heartbreaking to be part of that.
This is a blunt question. When, presumably as a doctor, as a nurse, you get used to death. It's part of your workplace. So yeah. Why does it matter if more people are dying in terms of how it affects your mental health? Isn't death death?
Yes, you are correct in that we are used to seeing patients die, but usually there's an explicable reason in terms of you understand someone's been in an accident, had a heart attack, had a stroke, or had something untoward, and patients dying are part of your everyday hospital life. However, when you see such a huge number of patients dying when you are feeling very helpless in terms of your treatments aren't working, the normal management plans aren't working, this does take its toll on you. It's a very different situation seeing four or five patients die in one day who are your age or ordinarily wouldn't have any place in a hospital at that point in their lives. So it does definitely is a different situation.
So finally, if this has been identified and we have many different physicians throughout our hospitals across the UK suffering from this, what do we do? How do we make them better?
It's a very good question, and I don't fully have the answer to that. The first point of call is to actually identify that this can actually be a problem for a number of people, and that you sometimes just questioning doctors, questioning healthcare staff, is there anything we can actually do? Are you still suffering from the effects? Is this something you want to talk about? Is actually the first step towards it. I know it's not a definitive solution, but it allows us to at least bring it into a discussion and allows us to formulate some form of solutions. As you saw from Professor Bong's testimony, how deeply impacting it was for him and for his staff.
Doctor, thank you for speaking to me this evening. Thank you. If you work within the NHS and you recognise this, it would be great to hear from you tonight, 0808 509 693, as we try to build the picture across the NHS, across the UK, with the aftermath of COVID. Many of us are thanking goodness that it's gone, it's behind us, but for some it's not.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
There have been warm tributes to Dame Maggie Smith, who's died at the age of 89. She was best known for her roles in the Harry Potter films and in Downton Abbey, and won two Oscars during a career that spanned seven decades. Hugh Bonneville, who also starred in Downton Abbey, said Dame Maggie was a true legend of her generation. Sir Nicholas Heitner directed her in The Lady in the Van, both on stage and on screen.
In her great performances, you think you've got the measure of her, but you never have. Because she's always ahead of you. She's always taking you somewhere thrilling, strange, interesting and unexpected.
Israel says it's bombed what it called Hezbollah's central headquarters in Beirut. The Lebanese health ministry said the attack killed at least two people and injured 76 others. The attack came shortly after the Israeli prime minister addressed the UN General Assembly in New York. America's top diplomat, Antony Blinken, said it was important for residents of northern Israel displaced by Hezbollah's rockets to be returned to home safely.
The question is, what's the best way to do that? What is the most effective, sustainable way to do that? We believe, many other countries who joined us in putting out a call for a ceasefire for 21 days believe, that the best way to do that is...